Hi, everyone, and welcome to the one and only podcast on the internet dedicated 100% to the greatest game in the world,
Advanced Squad Leader.
and we have two very, very special guests with us this evening. They are Bill and John. You want to introduce yourselves, gentlemen?
Sean, you want to go first?
Yep, go ahead, Bill.
Bill Cirillo.
Enough said.
Enough said. There we go. We're good.
Sean Deller. I'm design partner with Bill. And Bill and I have been working together for 20 something years.
That's a while.
Yes.
You work on,
Yes.
you look so young.
Beg your pardon. Do you work on more stuff together than ASL?
Yeah, mostly ASL. We do play an awful lot of Euro type games together, though, just to
Okay.
Yep.
fill the space.
And we've play tested a few other games as well, to some non-ASL war games.
And so, do you live in close proximity to each other?
We used to, and then somebody abandoned ship and moved to North Carolina.
No, it's never good.
This is something that I
No.
worry about. I'm up late because my wife always says we should move, and I can't move away from Dave.
Mean, you know,
I have kids too, but
and
Dave, I can't move away from Dave.
Yeah.
All your other
So,
gaming buddies.
yeah, the good news is the wife and I are relocating to North Carolina, so we'll be 3.5 hours closer to Sean.
Oh, that's
Toward
great.
the end of the year. So looking forward to that.
Well, that's working out. Your plan is working out very well.
Yes. Bitter Ender will be my new local tournament. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, we are certainly excited to have you both here. We interviewed Bill. I think, Sean, you were in the background on episode 97.
Yeah, I was in the background.
We
You're right.
should have just had you talk too. I don't know why we didn't, but so now we got you both, which is great, and we're on video, which I don't know if that's so great. Well, it is because we have the cool things that you guys have sent over to take a look at, and I'm extra excited having gone to Budapest and played walked at some of the ground and for the early scenarios, but we'll get to that later. So what would you guys like to open up with here tonight? Was it
We can open with the whole Budapest trip if you'd like.
No, let's do the real Twilight of the Reich and stuff like that.
Sure. Yep. First off, th thanks for having us. Really appreciate it. Long-time listeners, you guys always a great interview. Great for the hobby. So thank you for that. Appreciate
Well,
it.
and thank you.
Thank
Without
you.
guys like you, it would just be guys like us just babbling about the game. It wouldn't be. And the creativity of Dennis Donovan and that kind of stuff really helps.
Yeah.
But so
No, absolutely.
I can screen share too, so I got that figured out.
Sure. Twilight of the Reich. I guess we want to open with that. Sean and I were very excited for its release last at the last winter offensive in Bowie, Maryland. That was exciting for us. Our second major product after Festung Budapest. So that was all very exciting. And other than that, I just wanted to say that really appreciative for the not just my partnership with Sean, but the entire design community that we interact with, and our playtest team in this case, which I've listed in the credits. So that's one of the things I posted, sent to you, Dave, that
I've got that, yep.
yeah, I'm hoping we can get to at some point.
Right
Because
now I
without
could.
that, oh sure, because without that playtest community, what Sean and I do would just really be two guys sitting around a table, which is really not sufficient. We really do count on the team, and I've gone out of my way, and Sean's got out of his way to make sure it's clear to the community. We had a richness of talent on this modules, especially. We leveraged the community that we had for Budapest and then enhanced it, and it was just wonderful. If we had immediate playtest needs to get feedback on something that was kind of, really challenging us, great response. So, you know, without those guys. And then the same thing goes for individuals like Klaus Malmstrom, who I believe you've talked with in the past.
Yes.
And Perry and Chaz, just, you know, a great team to work for and a great team to work with. And I think part of what we want to do this evening, I think Sean and I was hoping to do, is go into some of our design process and how that design process interacts with MMP's development process, just so the community, you know, has a deeper appreciation for just how hard it is to actually get something out the door. I know you've had a number of designers and developers on over the years.
I
think they've, you know, all alluded to just how much effort it really goes into creating a product, whether it's a historical module or a module like Twilight of the Reich.
Yeah, yeah, so there's the list that I thought I had up the whole time we were talking, but yeah, a lot of great names there.
Yeah, we were just kind of spoiled with the richness of playtesters.
I think it is easy for players to sit back and just think, you know, I remember back in the day before so many wonderful modules have come out as they have over the last few years, players would just sit in the back and think, how come there's not more stuff coming out? But a lot of people don't realize how much work goes into these things, especially to have as big of products as you've put out. And those are big projects.
Yeah. So I think what we were hoping to do is, you know, just share some of that design approach and the timeline, just so everybody has a little, you know, deeper appreciation for just how much effort goes into this.
So I'm imagining Festung Budapest comes out, it releases, you guys get together, you slap each other on the back, maybe have a drink, and then you think, what's next? Is that how it happened? I mean,
or is it already going?
How long did it
take? So Festung Budapest started in 1999 when I read an article in the winter edition of Military History Quarterly, and realized that there was not a wealth at that time of scenarios set in Budapest. So, you know, off we went. And I want to be clear up front too. It initially started as a joint activity with Bruce Kirkcaldy. And the reason I'm mentioning this is it was just posted on Game Squad the other day that Bruce passed in the last week. So that was, you know, very sad news for Sean and I to read. But, you know, Bruce did a wonderful job laying out the initial map construct for Festung Budapest. And so that was 1999, and that finally got published in 2012. So almost 13 years in development. After Sean used to joke, after we finished Budapest, I think he had collected several hundred euro and military board games in his man cave that we just hadn't touched for like a decade. So we spent a lot of years doing non-ASL play, specifically just to kind of, you know, decompress.
Take a break then, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
And then 2017-ish time, Sean and I started chatting again, kind of getting that itch. Because, you know, our primary motivation is, well, one, we enjoy designing, and two, we feel like we're giving back to the hobby that's given us so much. Like I said, the playtest team, those guys, they don't just, you know, work with us. A lot of them are, you know, good friends that we've made over tournament gatherings over the last, you know, 35 years for me. So, you know, I consider a lot of these guys my second family in a lot of cases. So it's nice to have that. It's just, you know, and then Sean and I tend to gather 3, 4, 5 times a year at various tournaments around the country and interact with that community. A lot of the names that are listed in the place testing were guys that came forward at Oktoberfest or Winter Offensive and said, hey, is there something I can play test for you? So a lot of those guys, you know, volunteered on the spot. And so, you know, deeply appreciative of Guys stepping up at tournaments and saying, "Hey, how can I help?"
Yeah, that's excellent. So then Twilight came with a break in
Yeah,
between.
so let's see. There's a file. Let's see which file are we after. There's a letter that one pager that I sent. Sean and I crafted up, and I sent to Perry and Chaz and Brian.
I'll probably edit out while I'm searching for the thing.
Yep.
It's the
AP, AP proposal. Yeah, there we go. So that's how it, the AP proposal one gives you some insights into what we were thinking in that late 2018 timeframe by the time that we kind of got it all hashed together. And basically, we had an idea. We enjoyed doing an historical module, but there was a challenge associated with what we were envisioning at that time as an action pack that I think, kind of caught our fancy in the sense that you get a little more of a broader design opportunity with something like an action pack. You're not bounded by the dimensions of a historical battlefield. And so the creativity that it allows, kind of was attractive to us. And so
this was the original layout then. And this letter that we're sharing, and for viewers at home, I'll probably post this maybe on the page or something.
Yeah, you're good to do that. Sean and I had a rough idea of what we wanted out of such a product. And, we were thinking action pack at the time. We envisioned four of the 11 by 16 or fort style boards, as people like to refer to them. There were a few terrain situations that we thought were missing, even though there were roughly, I don't know, 70 some boards at the time. there were still things that we thought were missing from the systems. So we were hoping to fill some gaps. One of the things, there were tens of thousands of pieces of rolling stock in Europe at the time of World War II, a number of battles fought, over and for the rail yards. They were strategically important. They were tactically important. And so we felt that, that really hadn't been given a lot of representation other than a couple of rail cars and Valor of the Guard and Festung Budapest. So that was an attractive feature that we wanted to see if we couldn't, roll it into the core system. And MMP was amenable to such an approach. And then there were other features like debris, which were already, firmly ensconced in the hassles, but didn't really, show up in the core system. So there are a number of things that we thought that, unify or codify into the core system would be good design tools for the design community.
Yeah.
And so, what a lot of the, a lot of the content was then based on.
All the overlays of the railroads. Yeah. You just do massive things. And the graveyards I see too is in the letter.
Yeah. And
cemeteries.
Yeah. When we were doing the Budapest research, there were an awful lot of significant graveyards that, that 3, 4, 5 hex just really wasn't giving it, proper treatment. Same with when we started looking at the scenario set in Berlin, again, rather large graveyard construct. So we thought that would be an appropriate thing to roll in. Relative to the boards themselves, there was no real city park kind of board structure. So that was the 18AB. And then strangely, same with the factory board, other than the representation in barricades and Valor of the Guard, there really wasn't a dense factory complex type construct. So we thought, hey, that would be useful, especially with all the research that we had done in places like Budapest and Heilbronn that kind of just screamed out for that kind of a structure to a board. And then to tie it all together, we were kind of looking for a transition board between a heavier urban setting and more of a suburban type transition. So that's kind of eventually how the pack came together from a board perspective. And then the overlays kind of were, you know, designed on a basis of fitting in with those board designs so that we could come up with some overlays that kind of would cleanly overlay the map boards themselves. And we were trying to target both, you know, uses for fort style boards as well as the regular geo boards. So that was kind of what drove the majority of what we were envisioning as some kind of a future at that time action pack type process or module.
And then it just grew larger.
Yeah. So by the time we got into really understanding the boards, really understanding what we saw in terms of various railway, rail yard structures, the graveyards themselves. So the number of overlays started to grow. And I know that, you know, a lot of people in the community have real problems
they with overlays. They don't like cutting down things with their scissors?
Apparently not. But what we tried to do, though, is make significantly robust, large overlays that, you know, just weren't onesies and twosie hexes, but rather fundamentally would change the nature of a board.
Yeah, they're really large. I'm like, oh man, look at these things and look at this building and look at this, you know.
Yeah, and then it turns out, so the way the activity worked was in the 2018 timeframe, Sean and I were of the belief that one, we knew we wanted to work with Charlie Kibler again, because frankly, he's just the best. And our understanding was at the time when we initially proposed this was that we had an idea for what we wanted the boards to be, envisioning that Charlie would both design the boards and do the artwork for the boards. Well, that would turn out to be a fundamental misunderstanding on our part in terms of our conversations with Perry. Because Barry's like, no, unless you guys design the boards, this just isn't happening. So we figured, well, okay, let's sharpen our pencils and broaden our skill set. So ultimately, you know, I ended up doing the majority of the layout for all four boards and all the overlays, and I found I really liked it. I mean, it was
there you go.
Barry saying no was actually one of the better things that happened. on this project was I found out that it was a lot of fun to do this and educational. And one of the things, you know, that I can't really emphasize enough is I thought I understood ASL, and Sean, you know, can echo me on this. We thought we understood ASL as a system, but until you've designed a scenario and drawn a board and worked with an artist, there are just things that you're just like, whoa, didn't know that. And so it became a pretty huge learning process that started with Festa in Budapest. And the good news is I think that what we learned out of Budapest, we were really able to leverage in Twilight of the Reich. So I personally am much happier with what's in the Twilight of the Reich product. Even relative to Budapest, I think the scenarios are tighter. I think they're more fun to play. Again, you know, as I mentioned before, just having that freedom to use a broader set of settings across Europe was just more fun to do. Mm-hmm. And so while seven of the scenarios are still set in Budapest, all of them are set on the pest side of town this time, as opposed to the hassle, which 100% was set on the Buddha side.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we felt like there were still things we wanted to do and say about Budapest, but then there were other locations that were just, you know, rich and calling out for design.
Yeah. And then
I agree with Bill on that. And I would say that, you know, you would expect after going through a big project like Festung Budapest, and we learned a tremendous amount, we should leverage all those things we learned in the next one, whatever it was. And at that time, we didn't have Twilight, you know, as a, as the next step yet. It was a while before, you know, Bill came up with a concept for it, and then we were ready and dove into it. So we're very proud of this one in the sense that we made a deliberate effort to deliver something that was versatile for the players as well as the designers of the future, and a lot of fun to play.
Yeah, and then and now is this the new going to be like you think the new normal for most people's, or is this more particular than to this game, the right?
No, yeah. So let's talk about this. So
yeah, I guess listeners can't see me pointing to the
the
tables where you can buy things, right?
Yeah, Dave. Yeah,
can you that's part of the SSR.
Yeah, can you pull up the Twilight the TOTR SSR?
I feel like I'm kind of an idiot trying to.
And I'll also reinforce Bill's point about the map design. You can play ASL for decades, but until you actually have to try and design a map, there's levels of depth with designing a good geo board that we didn't realize until we started to get into it. Even more so than a historical one, because a historical one, you're trying to represent, you know, something one place, and there's a translation there into the ASL perspective that's important to get right. But the geo board brings a whole new dimension on how you want to design and lay out a board that we weren't even aware of back in the Festung Budapest days.
Can you give us any example of what, to pick one particular item that rises to the top as something you hadn't thought about that you would need to deal with?
Yes. So the with a historical module like Festung Budapest, you would have the aerial pictures if one was available for the area you're looking at. You'd have all sorts of historical maps, and that's your target. You know, it's a very specific kind of understanding of one type of terrain, and the challenge there is to get it into an ASL grid, and then make some tweaks to for design for effect. You know, you don't have to be a literal translation. It actually, your scenarios will play better with the design for effect philosophy, but it gives you a linear target, you know, you're marching towards. A geo one, you're going to go in different directions because you can rearrange them in different ways. So you want to make them compatible with various other boards. You have overlays that you think would be appropriate and possibly used, in which case you want to make the geo board, you want to design it so it receives those overlays well. And since this pack was sort of growing in size and scope, and we knew, you know, after a while what overlays were going to go in there, we were very specific to make sure that those overlays had good places to fit in these, you know, geo boards here.
Yeah. So well, like roads aren't like shooting out from underneath them in various.
Bingo. Ways. Yep. You're absolutely right. So there's a whole new dimension that you sort of have to start looking at, and all that. And still what's also common is just the way you depict certain terrain types and how they get laid out in the spacing. There's a couple people in the ASL community that are board designers and are really good at it. And they see the boards a whole different way than most of us do. Mm-hmm. And so we got exposed to that and tried to learn as much as possible from those folks.
Yeah, Dave. So this wasn't the actual sheet, but as long as it's up, let's talk to this because I think reinforces some of the points here. When we were creating the large rail yard overlays, including the railway station one, which is shown there on the left, they're a different beast from a line of sight perspective than anything else in the system. And so how you tactically interact with them became a learning activity for Sean and I early in both the design and the playtest process. And so one of the things that we did was took those overlays in their earliest form and try to develop an understanding of the lines of sight and the movement associated with a pretty complex construct to get it into as highly playable a format as possible. And so understanding the lines of sight, which are shown there in the yellow, where they start and where they terminate, became fundamentally important. There's equivalent diagrams like this for the bypass considerations of what is and is not bypassable. One of the other things that we learned in the process was, Sean and I were playtesting one of the scenarios, and I'm driving a T-34 up a rail yard, and I get into a part of the yard where I can't, by the current bypass rules, continue to bypass. Oh. Well, every one of those hexes that you go to bypass with a rail card is 5 movement points, because it's, you know, 2 on each side and 1 to change covered arc.
Yeah.
Well, suddenly I'm going to throw it in reverse and back up like 5 of those. Yeah, that tank's done. I mean, that tank is out of the scenario. So it was one of those epiphanies of, this isn't really going to fly from a playability perspective. So talked it over with Perry, talked it over with Klaus, and came to an agreement that that whole, you know, measuring bypass by the thickness of a AFV counter really was not useful in this kind of a situation. And really was going to bog play down to the point of, yeah, you know, having to spend an inordinate amount of time sitting there staring at a hex row to say, yeah, can I get through there or not? And so, you know, Perry was highly amenable to just saying, yeah, I know, I agree with you from a playability perspective. Let's amend the rail yard vehicle bypass rules, where fundamentally you can just bypass a rail car independent of clearance.
Oh, and so that's in there now. In the
yeah, so it just, it really just made it much, it's still expensive to go down a rail yard, don't get me wrong. But it doesn't become a burdensome activity. You can do the math pretty quickly once you get used to the rail yards. So that's a good example, I think, of what we saw in a change in the system from a hassle to a incorporation in the core system that we thought it was a much better innovation. So Dave, what you're looking for is the TOTR SSR's file.
Right. But if you want to put that other one up for just a second, real quick, one more point on that.
Yeah, I'll grab it.
And that is, if you can envision when you've got the scenario out and you're playtesting it, and you're moving through a large rail yard, you know, so picture maybe a couple of these side by side, you know, across the board, and you're moving from left to right. What you are seeing is depictions of where the los are, and where the los is where you could throw fire lanes down. Right, and if the attacker is moving from left to right, then if there's not points at which those lines of sight are broken and the lines of fire, then it could be brutal if you're trying to punch through 8, 10, 12 hex rows of rail cars, because there's a fire lane coming on every one of them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was some deliberate looking at how a scenario would actually unfold during play, and then we would tweak the overlay layouts, because you want to make it so that the attacker has a chance to make some progress at a reasonable pace. But you also don't want to make it impossible for the defender. And so all of that kind of went into the development of these overlays.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I get it.
Plus, we had the extra burden that there's a couple of train guys in the ASL community, so we just couldn't go willy-nilly with our track designs. We were still trying to, you know, use our best model railroader, techniques and laying these out. We still caught flack for a few switching situations that
people noticed aren't realistic.
We were told weren't realistic, but hey, you know.
You don't want to argue with the train guys.
No.
No.
They're a lot like us.
Yes. Okay. So in addition to the maps and what we were hoping that they would capture from a adding to the system. Sean and I talked over the philosophy of what we were hoping the scenario and the product would represent from a play perspective. And so a lot of what's shown here in these SSRs are incorporations of design features that are included in the historical modules.
Yeah.
And and just so it's clear, and I'm going to I'll talk about this a little bit more. There was as much historical research, if not more, done for these 17 scenarios than we did for Festo in Budapest.
Wow.
So, and for a couple of reasons. One, we had developed a broader community that we could, you know, tap for historical research. Two, the internet is just a lot more powerful in terms of what's on it relative to historical information. And three, there's just a lot more, you know, books and research that have been done since the time of Budapest. And so we tried to bring as much historical accuracy to Twilight of the Reich as we did in Festa in Budapest. So to that end, Sean and I, you know, had long conversations on what were a number of the features in the historical modules that we thought, without being too burdensome, would increase the quality of the challenge for both the defender and especially for the attacker. And so often when you play a scenario, it, you know, if you're a quality attacker, you can look at a guy's defense and say, yeah, there's a high confidence that the heavy machine gun's there, high confidence that he may have placed an AT gun there. And so the concept of the representation of the fog of war that existed in the core system, we were trying to kind of, you know, turn the dial and amp up a little bit. And so to that end, we incorporated at least a squad equivalent worth of HIP in each scenario. We incorporated what would be envisioned as a flat defensive setup in the sense that you, the defender is free to record both any leaders that are stacked with a squad or half squad or any support weapons. And so when you do a setup for any one of these 17 scenarios, you're, as an attacker, you're pretty much looking at a board that's telling you a lot less information than in a normal scenario.
I think that's, yeah, that's been one of the complaints people have had for quite a while about the game, that it's too easy to figure out that out and see too much.
Yeah, so we tried to address that. Now, whether we've been successful or not, you know, only time will tell. But based on all the playtest feedback, as much as some of the guys were somewhat reluctant to do the recording, ultimately, once you got comfortable with it, it really wasn't that much of an overhead. Now, we do have a Sean Deller rule in that one of the trickier things is if you use your HIP and you have a leader stacked with them and the squad leaves that hex, the leader can stay hidden there. He's free to do that. With the setup of the recording, a leader is not free to do that. Once the guy he's stacked with leaves, the guy has to go on board and move with him. Now, one of the two of us repeatedly had problems with that, so I'm not naming names, Sean. But yeah, so that came to be referred to as the Sean Deller rule. So we think that those, you know, some pretty simple changes, I think, really amp up the challenge for an attacker in these scenarios. And there is a little bit of a learning curve. I'll be right up front with that. And then the other big design feature, what we referenced from a smaller perspective than you would in a regular hassle is the purchase, ability to purchase weapons. And just to be clear, you know, the Death to Fascism packs that Peter Streif and Mozzie put out, they really emphasize the same thing. So I want to be clear here. This wasn't some epiphany on our part between the hassles and what, you know, Peter did. We you know, leveraged off of that or paid homage, if you want to get French about it. Because what we liked was it provided additional uncertainty into just what exactly each side was about to face.
Yeah.
And so, and it gave players an ability to somewhat tailor both a defense and attack to some of their strengths that you typically do not get in a scenario. So all 17 scenarios in the pack incorporate the ability for both the attacker and the defender to purchase some number of additional either support weapons, fortifications, and or mortar systems to augment what's given to them already in their order of battle.
Yeah, and of course, all that increases the replayability of these scenarios too.
Yeah, no, yeah, Dave, excellent point. That was another one of our design goals was in an age in which you've got 6,000-7,000 scenarios to choose from, and typically we've entered an age of one and done, unless it really becomes like a tournament favorite to incorporate. That we were hoping that the additional replayability aspect would keep a lot of these scenarios fresh for years. And the guys would say, well, fundamentally, I don't like the approach I just took. Hey, let's replay it. Sean and I, you know, even though we don't live close together now, we do try and get together, you know, once or twice a year and do the initial vetting on all of the scenarios that we design. And so we've taken some, you know, pretty radically different approaches. There's a couple of scenarios that you have a choice of going, you know, heavy support weapon or heavy fortification based. And I've seen, you know, not only ourselves, but other playtesters, you know, use approaches in which they gave up buying all support weapons and bought into fortifications and developed some, you know, pretty highly effective defenses that, you know, weren't readily apparent that they were, you know, effective in nature. And so, like I said, you know, it really gives the players a lot of flexibility to tailor to, you know, what they think best meets their needs.
And it contributes to what Bill and I consider one of the ingredients to a good scenario design, and that is creating angst for the both players, the decisions that they have to make.
And, yeah.
And, you know, and the weapons purchases, the uncertainty of what each side may have, the uncertainty on how the defense is actually laid down is all more angst, and it creates tough choices at times for the players.
Yeah, that's something I don't know. I'm not sure I need more of that when I'm
Yeah, Sean and I are huge proponents of the card-driven game systems just because the angst level in some of those games is pretty tremendous.
Yeah, it's so funny. Even after playing thousands of scenarios, then I'm sitting down with Timonen last week. Well, he's coming tomorrow night. We're going to keep playing through the Festoom scenarios. And, it's so funny. It was just like, you know, I should know how to set up a defense by now. Well, I think I do, but then Dave too. Like, why is this so difficult? It's just angst, you know. Look for fire lane stuff, look for your rallying points, you know. We know it, but it's when you start doing it, you realize you don't have quite enough people you thought you had to shift around on the board.
One of the best compliments was an after action report we read recently where one of the guys who's been playing for like 30 years basically looked at one of the scenarios and said, wow, I'm not sure I understand how to set up a defense for this one. And I'm like, hey, that's music to my ears that, you know, here is a highly experienced player. And it was a new challenge for him to see how it all kind of, you know, went together. And, his write-up was pretty excellent in the sense that he, you know, admitted fully at the end, I would do things radically different if I had to do this again. So.
Yeah. And Jeff and I have to remember which squad had the light machine gun, not realize it after he's already been overrun. Oh wait, he had the light machine gun now.
Yeah. Well, yes. So there is a bit of that, but you know, good bookkeeping, you know, does help, to the point where we thought that the level of change that produced a value was worth the bookkeeping effort for mm-hmm. these scenarios.
Yeah,
and you asked, you know, was this going to be a new thing? One of our next projects that Sean and I are working on right now is a Twilight of the Reich themed journal, in which a number of designers are going to, you know, are contributing, where they're using the same, some number of those SSRs. They don't have to use all of them, but typically they're incorporating, you know, one, two, or three of them. And so, okay, you know, including the weapons purchase table. So, so the plan is you will see more of these scenarios, you know, in the future.
Yeah. Somebody did send in the question to us asking if that was on the burner, back burner, front burner.
Yeah. It's on the, it's actually on the front burner. We're actually play testing right now as we speak.
So. Okay. Yeah. Good to know. Good to know.
Yeah.
And then, looking at the next item, the scenario area for 296 from Festoon.
Yeah. Okay. So I just wanted to give you a sense of, well, one, this is a little bit of a teaser that's coming at some point. So I want to do two things here. One, this gives players a sense of what some of the boards look like with the major overlays added.
Oh, so, okay.
That 2A is now, you know, at the time these were the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. That was, you know, bold numbering on our part. That's the 17A factory board with two of the major railroad overlays on it. That middle board is 18A with both graveyards in it.
Yeah, look at that.
And then that's 16A with the larger railway station on the right. Those three boards ultimately, when put together in that configuration, we're going to, future plan is to build a mini linkage of either the scenarios themselves or a little mini, you know, campaign game that's geo board based. Yeah, can you go to the Budapest scenario area with the one that's got the aerial recon photos?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what that file is about to show is it's the same three maps with the associated overlays, but I've married it. The diagram is married to the aerial recon photos from Budapest against which those three boards and the associated overlays were designed for.
This is cool.
so there's the same three boards. This is an area in on the Pest side of Budapest. That's a large factory complex shown there on the left. That the Soviets came in from what would be the from the left-hand side there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Diagram, while also pushing from the bottom of the diagram up. So you've got the factory complex, you've got the associated rail yard, which the Hungarians reinforced. They loaded a lot of the flat cars up with steel bundles and put support weapons up on the rail cars. And then there's one of the scenarios deals with an iron concrete, ferro-concrete wall that the Soviets had a heck of a time breaching that was the west entrance into that large graveyard. And so where that white dot is on the left, that is all graveyard in the Pest side of Budapest, which then led into the horse race track. And there's another one of those famous, you know, horse race tracks. And then sitting right on the top side of it there with all the stables in which the Hungarians, you know, pulled the horses out of Budapest to get them out of the battle. And that's, you know, the one thing that we had a harder time representing at scale, but that's what that open area is there on the right-hand side a playboard. That's an overlay.
Oh, I see it.
Yeah.
And then between the, blue, the stone buildings and the brown and the
They're right there. Perfect. Yep.
I got it.
And then the blue dot, that's the Eastern Railway Station. So I don't know how you arrived in Budapest, Dave, but the train that the Cirillo family took into town there about 5 years ago, we disembarked in that railway station. And so that drawing there is, I got Charlie to draw that railway station from the actual image, overhead image of the Eastern Railway Station. Yeah. So that's the beauty of Charlie, is he's more than willing to work with you if you want to add design features in like that. And then he was great about, you know, laying the railroad cars in for us and building those constructs. Yeah. So our future plan is, you know, tie these four scenarios together or build a little mini, you know, CG around it.
Exciting.
But you can, so when I reference that, you know, we put as much historical research into the creation of a geo board. Yeah, we tried to do that on a number of for a number of features. Not shown here that in the pack is I think the 5X railway station, the skinny one in there. That's the Nijmegen railway station drawn to scale, the historical one in the overlay package. And then the powder keg is a cylindrical building that was in the park there in Nijmegen. So, you know, Charlie went above there to once again, you know, make generic overlays that are actually historically based. So that's, you know, part of the joy of working with Charlie.
Yeah, this looks really cool. And I'd have a mini campaign game on that. No?
Yeah. So whether that makes the journal or not, that's still up in the air, but that's, you know, one of our future projects is to build that, you know, much like the peach shelling ones that he's done over the years for, I think he's now done three of them.
Yeah.
Over time. So.
All right. Well,
fantastic.
I guess all good things have to come to an end. This will be two shows, I'm sure.
Okay.
So I guess anything else from you gentlemen or Jeff or anyone?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you. I appreciate what you guys do for the hobby. The time and effort you put into this is tremendous. I don't know if you remember, I rode the elevator with you one time when you guys covered Oktoberfest.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Years ago, the one time you came in and broadcast from the lobby there.
Right.
There was that super sketchy elevator that sometimes took you to the sixth floor and sometimes stopped.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Third.
Yeah, I rode up with you one morning. So, yeah.
Okay.
You know, always a mystery on where you're going to end up.
Yeah, yeah. We've got to go back out.
We got
to. Jeff's still working. Oh,
so the new facility is ideally set up for you gentlemen because there's the place that Brett's now got has a super large lobby that would be ideal to set up a broadcast.
Wouldn't hear all the jars clanging in the background.
Yeah. Well, and some of us played in the hallway itself too. I mean, in the lobby area, because it was, you know, you could spread out. So it's a great facility.
All right. Well, should we sign off then?
I guess so. Thank you very much, guys. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Good. And we'll hope to see you again soon.
Yeah.
Deal.
Sooner than the 200 shows in between, which blew my mind.
Yeah, but you know, we'll get to you before 500. So yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But in the meantime, remember to roll low
and rally well, but not when you're playing us. All right.
All right. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
All right. Hey, thanks, Dave. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, guys.